not just going to be talking about employed work. This passage isn't written to people who were employed and wasn't written to people who were paid. I'm talking about your daily, could be employed work, could be being a student, it could be your daily volunteering, the daily task, the daily job, the thing you do day to day. What's your relationship with that occupation, that vocation? I wonder if it's a bit like Mr. Incredible. Mr. Incredible is part of a family called The Incredibles. You may have seen the film. If you haven't, don't worry. It's good. I recommend it. At the beginning of the film, The Incredibles, superheroes are banned from society. And so they all have to go and get normal jobs. And after the scene where superheroes are banned, it cuts to Mr. Incredible, huge guy, super strength, sat in a tiny office cubicle working for an insurance company with a face as grey as a storm cloud, just looking miserable. And he answers the phone and goes really monotone, and he doesn't want to be there because he's Mr. Incredible. That's not what he's supposed to be doing. He sees work as empty and an inconvenience. Our society can often portray work as empty or an inconvenience. Work is just the thing that you need to get done in order to get to the leisure activity. Work is the thing you need to get done so you can make time for or earn enough money for that holiday. Or get it out of the way so I can really express myself. If I work hard enough, maybe I can even retire early. Work can be seen as empty, but also work can be seen as everything. Work can be seen as what identifies us. Can be the center of our life. Another one of my favorite TV shows is a show called Suits, and the main character in that is a guy called Harvey Specter. And at one episode in Suits, he receives a phone call, and he finds out that one of his colleagues has retired because there's more to life than work. Harvey Specter puts the phone down, and he just goes, idiot. Because, well, of course, there's not more to life than work. You want to be successful, you want to be rich, you want to be famous. In busy Manchester, up-and-coming Manchester, you want to be successful, you want to make the grade, you want to show people that you are worth it, you want to show that your existence has meaning, you want to make an impact on this world. Wonder what your relationship with work is. Does it feel empty, monotonous, boring? Do you feel stuck in your job, or is work everything to you? Or maybe it's something in between. I think this passage has something to say to all of us in our work, in our daily grind, because it's written to bondservants or slaves and their masters. We'll come onto that relationship in a little bit, but bondservants were people who were stuck in their occupation. They didn't get a choice in what they did. We're strange in our culture that we get to even have the choice, even consider what we might do for a living. That's a very new, very novel thing in history. He's writing to people who are stuck in their occupation, in their vocation. And their work is everything. Their life is work. It's because it has to be. He's writing to people in difficult work circumstances. So let's talk about the fact that he's writing to bondservants. Why doesn't Paul in this moment take the opportunity to speak out against slavery, to put an end to it once and for all? Well, not going to go into everything that the New Testament says about slavery right here, right now. That's a conversation for another time. But here's two things which is helpful for our thoughts this evening. Firstly, Paul is providing us here with a worldview. He's reframing the relationship between bondservant and master, employer and employee, person in authority and person under authority. He's reframing that relationship, providing a worldview that brings us, as someone wrote, the seed for the scuppering of slavery. He's providing a worldview that says masters and bondservants are equal. he's providing the Christian worldview that says, actually, no matter what your status in life, you are of equal dignity, value, and worth. And that was revolutionary at the time. A guy called Plato, you may have heard of him, famous philosopher, he wrote that slaves could just be executed for just a tiny misdemeanor. Aristotle wrote that slaves were of no more importance than oxen, cattle that the master might own. An old proverb of the time says that slaves should be schooled by the whip. Paul writes in Colossians 3, verse 11, here in the family of God there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised, uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is all and in all. And at the end of Colossians, in chapter 4, verses 8 and 9, he mentions a guy called Onesimus, who is an escaped slave. And he calls believers, particularly in the letter of Philemon, to accept this slave as a beloved brother. Paul is providing us here with a worldview that people like William Wilberforce would use to dismantle the slave trade. He's providing us with a worldview which was revolutionary. He was providing us with this idea of equality that comes from Christianity. You can't trace it back in the history of secular thought. If you trace it back, the thought history of equality, you'll get to this guy called Jesus Christ. If you can't prove, it comes from Jesus, not from history, not from science. It's a worldview that leads to the scuppering of slavery. Now, we must acknowledge that slavery is still prevalent nowadays, very sadly. And we also must acknowledge that Christians have played their part in wrong treatment of people throughout the ages. I read a guy called John Dixon recently, and he said this. He said, Jesus and the New Testament writers wrote a beautiful tune. A beautiful tune. And that tune is beautiful because of all that it is and it says. But sometimes Christians have played that tune badly. But the tune is nonetheless beautiful. And Paul here is providing us with a tune, a worldview that scuppers slavery. That's the first little thing. And the second thing about this relationship between masters and servants is that Paul here isn't interested right now in for his purposes in changing people's circumstances. He's most interested in what is our heart towards God in the midst of our circumstances. Paul is saying, no matter what the circumstance, no matter what your job, no matter what your daily grind, he calls us in this passage to work for the Lord. Whether slave, free, employee, employer, dead-end job or clear idea of clear career progression, whether you're a student, whether you're a teacher, whether you're well-paid or poorly paid, whether you've got a good boss or a bad boss, here in this passage he calls us five times to remember the Lord, to work for the Lord. He tells us that work is worship. In verse 22, he says we are to work fearing the Lord. In verse 23, he calls us to work for the Lord. In verse 24, he calls us to remember the reward we have in Christ. In verse 24, again, he says, you are serving the Lord Christ. In verse 25, this is kind of a bonus one, but he's alluding to the justice of God. And in chapter 4, verse 1, he says, masters, remember that you have a master in heaven. He calls us in this passage to work for the Lord, no matter what our circumstance. Because the most important thing is not how do I change my circumstance. It's actually, in my current circumstance, how is my heart towards the Lord? How am I living towards the Lord? What is my attitude towards God? And this passage calls us not to work for the paycheck, the reputation, or the status, but work for the Lord. And it shows us that work is not empty because we work for the ultimate boss. We work for the Lord as an act of worship. But it also shows us that work is not everything because there is a higher purpose in our work, and that is to work for the Lord. When we see that our work is ultimately for the Lord, it transforms, it invigorates, it renews our purpose in our work. And so let's just consider three quick things about how working for the Lord transforms our work. It gives us a renewed purpose in our work. It gives us a motivation for our work, and it gives us a radical vision for how the workplace should be. So firstly, it gives us a renewed purpose for our work. So in verse 22, Paul addresses the bond servant, the person under authority. So for our purposes, it could be an employee, it could be a student, it could be the volunteer. He says, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. So verse 22, obey in everything. Not in some things, not in the things that are convenient. Not when you feel like it. Obey in everything. It's not calling us to be immoral. Because in verse 25 it says there's going to be accountability. And in chapter 4 verse 1 it says treat your masters, treat your bondservants fairly. But it's calling us to obey in everything out of reverence and fear for God. Obey in everything in the Lord, if you like. And don't just obey when the boss is looking. Don't just obey when you can be seen. Don't be disobeying and putting your feet up when the eyes are off you. Don't be gossiping about the boss and bad-mouthing about the culture rather than working when the eyes are off. There's a scene in one, again, another one of my favourite films, called School of Rock. And School of Rock is about a guy who he pretends he's a cover teacher at a school and takes on a class, and instead of teaching, he turns them into a rock band. It's my dream job. And while they're doing their rock band rehearsals, at one point, there's one scene where they hear the headmistress coming and they launch into and he goes, quick, everyone, do the plan. And they turn it the rehearsal room back into a classroom. They sit in their seats and he starts teaching maths, and it's all good by the time the head teacher comes. And then the head teacher goes and it's like, right, back to rock band rehearsals. That's what Paul is calling us not to do. we're to work heartily, we're to work with sincerity of heart, whether the boss is watching or not. We're to be, I think we're Christians, we're to be the best employee, the best worker. Not the most successful, not the most popular, but the most sincere. Because we're to work at the same pace, whether the boss is watching or not. We're not to go into overdrive just to try and impress the boss when we you know, get that assignment that could get us noticed. We're not to slack off when the eyes are off us. We're to work with sincerity of heart no matter what the circumstance. Because work is worship. Work is worship. Obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. We work out of reverence, out of fear for the God who created us to work. The God who created work in Genesis 2 as part of his good creation. Work comes before the fall in Genesis 3. It's part of God's good creation. We were made to work. There's something pleasing to God when we work. And as we work, we image him. Because as God took chaos and made order when he created, so when I take the bins out at my office, I am taking that chaos and creating order. A little picture of what God does. Even the most menial tasks can be worship to the Lord. I often say to my kids now, tidying up is not beneath us as human beings. Because when, you know, when I ask my kids to clear up their toys, they go, no, Dad. Oh, and when I have to clear up, I think that inside. I don't express it like my children, but I still think that inside. But tidying up is a very God-like task, because God took, what does he do in creation? He takes chaos and he creates order. And as we do a task like that, we are imaging him. We take chaos and we create order. And when we think like that, even the most menial tasks become worship. And that gives us renewed purpose in my work. When I do that exam paper and I take that, this might not work as an analogy, but I take that random sea of equations and letters and numbers and create and turn it into a solution, I'm taking chaos and creating order. When I take that problem that a client has come to me with and I create a solution, I'm taking chaos and creating order. I'm imaging God, and if I do so for the Lord, it's worship. And because of that, it has eternal value. Because it's pleasing to God. And ultimately, that's my ultimate purpose in my work. And that's true no matter what my role. My work can have eternal value, whether I am well paid, badly paid, whether I am overworked, underworked, whether I am a full-time employee, whether I'm unemployed, whether I'm retired. Working for the Lord gives renewed purpose in my work. Secondly, we get a motivation for our work. Because we're called in verse 23, whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. In these times, New Testament times, slaves were not paid. They weren't allowed to inherit property either. But what does Paul remind them in verse 24? Remember, he's speaking to bondservants. This is radical things he's saying. He says, you will receive a reward. You will receive an inheritance. So what is the motivation for the Christian employee? Not pay, not promotion, not plaudits. The reward, the inheritance from my Father in heaven. It's the best inheritance. It's the best bonus anyone could hope to receive, because it's an internal inheritance. 1 Peter chapter 1 speaks of an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for us. So the Christian works knowing, not motivated by the paycheck at the end of the month, but knowing that I have a reward in heaven, knowing that my Father will give me an inheritance, not because I've earned it, not because I'm employee of the month, but because he is full of grace. And there's no favoritism with the Lord. Verse 25 says, there is no partiality with the Lord. How do I earn this inheritance? How do I earn this reward? Well, it's a free gift, isn't it? Not by my works. We're given it through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. In fact, Romans 4 says, to the one who does not work and believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness. As a Christian, I work knowing I have an eternal, unimaginable, unspoilable, unperishable inheritance kept in heaven for me. I had a friend at uni, and he knew that at some point in the near future, he was going to inherit his dad's company. He was going to take it over. He was going to be the boss. And he knew before that he had a job waiting for him straight out of uni as one of the top dogs in the company. And knowing that changed the way he approached his degree. As you can imagine, he approached his degree with a certain element of freedom. And it wasn't, you know, he was a 20-year-old guy. So it wasn't all, you know, particularly, it wasn't an example I encourage you to follow. But there was a freedom in the way he approached his exams, for instance. He was at uni. We studied music. So he was at uni because he enjoyed music. He was at uni to kind of have a good time. But he still did the exams and he still tried to do well. But he was free, knowing that he wasn't at the mercy of the exam board, because he had this inheritance waiting for him. He wasn't dictated to by his results, because his future was secure because of who his father was and his relationship with him. Likewise, when I work knowing that my reward is in heaven, I'm freed. I'm freed from idolizing the praise of my boss, for instance, because I have a far better reward that I have that is not dependent on my performance. I can be truly happy for the success of others because I have a reward. I have an inheritance in heaven. I can respond well to criticism or failure because my identity is secure, because my Father is in heaven. He loves me and knows me, and no one can take away my inheritance in him. And that frees me to work for the good of others and not for personal gain, because there's nothing I can gain off other people that is going to ever match the reward I have in heaven. And it also frees me to be a witness at work. It frees me to speak for Jesus, to live for Jesus, to hold to the beliefs of Jesus, even though it might hinder my chances of climbing the career ladder. Even though it might mean saying no to certain hours because, I'm committed to church at this time, or I'm going to do this thing for Jesus. But it frees me. Frees me to live differently. It frees me to follow Jesus rather than following the current, which we can get caught up in, of work, 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 work. Of achieve, 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 of I must prove myself. Even if my job is empty and actually my work, 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 work is just to try and afford that 2-week holiday in the summer. Knowing I have an inheritance frees me in my work. But lastly, these verses give a vision, a radical vision for the workplace, which I think was radical then, but I think is actually just as radical now. And this is taken from some writing from John Stott. He notices three things. That in this passage, firstly, that in this passage, all parties, both bondservants and masters, are given duties. And that was revolutionary at the time. But he gives the duty of the slave and employee is to obey, not begrudgingly, but working heartily, offering themselves freely. He's giving an element of freedom and dignity to the slaves even in that, because he's saying, offer yourselves. You're not just a possession, you are a human being with autonomy who can offer yourself. Slaves are called to obey. Masters are called to treat slaves and bondservants justly and fairly. There's duties on both sides. Slaves or employees or whoever, obey. Master or boss, be just, be fair. The next thing Stott writes is that both parties are called to concentrate on their duties and not their rights. Servants, you have a duty here to do good work, to work heartily, no matter whether the boss is looking or not, whether the boss is paying attention or not. You're working for the Lord, so work well. Master, because you have a master in heaven, be good to your employee, be a good boss, treat them well, be just and be fair. And what happens is that each party is called to focus not on my rights, not on what I can get out of other people, but what can I give? What is my role in this task? Because back in the day, the slave had no access or recourse for justice, had no dignity, value or worth. But here Paul is saying, masters, be just, be fair. But slaves, employees, do good work. And it's a call to focus, and this is why it's revolutionary now. It's a call to focus not on what I can get, but on what I can give. So often the posture of the employee is to think, what are my working conditions? Think of, what have I received my holiday pay? Have I taken all my annual leave? Am I employers making good conditions for me? That can consume. Equally, employers, masters can think, are these people doing enough? Am I getting value for money? What am I getting? That can so easily become our posture, can't it? Naturally, because we're human beings. We naturally think, what am I getting out of this? But here, the first concern of the employees is to improve their productivity, is to work heartily, is to do the task and not think about the conditions of their work. But the first concern of the master, the employer, is to improve conditions, is to make a good workplace, is to be just and fair and not think about how do I get these people to be more productive. It's a picture of mutual service. It's a picture of equality. It's a picture of forgetting ourselves. It's a picture of mutual service, which is a radical vision for then and a radical vision for now, for the days, for the workplace. And why can Paul call them to this? Well, because both have the same heavenly master. The heavenly master who calls masters to provide for their servants and calls servants to carry out the task, who calls bosses to humble themselves. But he calls employees to humble themselves too. How can he do that? Why can he do that? Well, because the master of heaven humbled himself to be a servant of the lowest of the low. He came from heaven to earth. He took on the form of a servant. He came not to be served, but to serve and give up his life as a ransom for many. To provide us with that inheritance. He went to death. He suffered death on the cross to pay for our sins and bring us into his family. He rose from the grave, bringing us hope of eternal life. Masters are called to provide, but look how the ultimate master has provided for you. Look how the ultimate master has saved you and has given you that eternal inheritance, that eternal reward. And so it frees us, no matter what our situation, to think, how can I work for him? Maybe my boss is a bit of a terror, but actually I'm serving the Lord who loved me and gave himself for me and knows me and has a plan for me, which might not be the plan that I would choose, but I know he's good. And I know if he calls me to do hard things, he's not calling me to do anything that he wouldn't do himself, because he became a servant in order to redeem me. And it also humbles the master, who knows that there is no fully autonomous human. You're not the king of the castle. There is a king who is above you, but there is also but that king has also lowered themselves and provides this vision of leadership that is so beautiful and so attractive that when we follow it, it creates this radical, beautiful vision of leadership. So let's let the cross, let's let the Lord, let's let his vision for work, for the daily grind, let's let his call, let it give us a purpose, give us a motivation, and give us that radical vision for mutual service in the workplace. Let me pray. Just going to read